所以啊，是我们今天很荣幸啊，我们那个行政院的政务委员唐凤有来我们现场，啊，we're very happy to have our digital minister of Taiwan is come to our DevConf 18, and I don't even have to tell him what to say because he knows what to do.
Thank you, everyone. Happy to be here. So to somewhat compensate the lack of Q&A time in the previous session, we will start with the Q&A. And if you have any device connected to the internet, please go to this website. It's called slido.com, S-L-I-D-O.com. And once you're on this website, you'll be asked to enter a number. So without a hash, it's just 728 or today's date. And once you enter the three digits, and you can press join or a small like green button, and then you'll be dropped into this anonymous or pseudonymous chat channel. And here, feel free to ask me anything, like literally anything. And if you see other people's questions that you would also like to see me answer, you can just press like. And the questions with the most number of likes will float to the top on this projection here. And for the rest of this hour, I guess, the next 15 minutes, I'll begin with a short introduction, maybe 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes, about my work in the Taiwan administration in the public digital innovation space, the PDIS, as you're seeing here. But meanwhile, as I'm talking, feel free to ask me any and all questions, which will show up in the phone here. And once there's sufficient number of questions, then I'll switch right back to Slido. My current favorite programming language is text/plain. Character set UTF-8. It's one of the most versatile programming language there is, and I'll explore that more in my talk. I'm sure it's your favorite programming language too. Okay, so let's get started. Unlike many people working on democracy today, I'm an optimist when it comes to democracy, and especially internet democracy. This strange condition began when I was 15 years old. That was 1996. I discovered that the future of human knowledge, and indeed future of democracy, is happening on the web, and my education in the school is all out of date. So I told my teachers that I found this wonderful constitutional democracy called Debian. No, really, I did. On the internet, where people use Condorcet methods and those very advanced algorithms and policy development process and so on. And I want to quit school and begin my education on the wide web. And surprisingly, my teachers were very reasonable people, and they all agree with it. And so after that, I just dropped out of high school and started a few web startups and just participate in this wonderful community of like the Internet Society and the open source and free software communities to basically see that how people can come to consensus, or at least consent, through radical transparency and rough consensus and so on. And so today I'm Taiwan's digital minister for a year and a half now. I'm applying the lessons that I learned when I was 15 years old, that is to say civic participation, rough consensus, radical transparency to the representative democratic system here. And surprisingly, it's working and it's changing gradually our society. Now, So a year and a half, 2 years ago, actually, when President Tsai Ing-wen first became inaugurated as our president, she said an inspiring statement in her inauguration speech. She said, before, when we think of democracy, we think about the opposition between two opposing values. But now, from now on, Taiwan's democracy need to become a conversation between many diverse values. So the key point here is the plural of this word value. So there's many values in Taiwan, and we're going to build a conversational, deliberative democracy out of those very different but diverse values. And indeed, previously, when people think about the government or the state or things like that, people tend to have this picture, like we have different different departments, we had different ministries, we had different council within the parliament who talked to, for example, the environmental agency may talk to the environmentalist groups, the Ministry of Economy may talk to, you know, developmental, you know, more capitalistic groups and so on. So there's different nodes within the government to talk to the different sides of stakeholders, and people imagined that the government is what brings people together and who arbitrates between those conflicting or opposing forces. Now, this model of governance, as all of you know, has become bankrupt within the previous decade or so with the advent of the social web and indeed the internet activism. And the reason is that people can organize now perfectly fine without a representative organizer from the mainstream media or from the representative democracy. And also because there's so many emerging issues, we can't have a different ministry or a different agency for each of them. And so if the government insists on being still this kind of rope in between, not only is its organizational value much lower than before, it will be torn between so many different interests that it become paralyzed. And so the distance between the government and the people, while not increasing, the distance between people and people have much shortened, and it leads to a recession or a distrust to the democratic institutions. So the way we're working on this is basically reimagine the questions governance systems ask. Instead of asking, you know, who we need to represent or what is fair arbitration, we ask instead what is the due process in which that the various different stakeholders can find common values. And given the common values, can we come up with solutions that works for everyone, that everyone can live with? And so this is the idea of civic tech, or basically technology that enable people to listen to one another. And this has basically a lot of international metrics measuring this, like the diversity of gender and participation in the internet, like the rank of like open data and accessibility, like the access to e-participation platforms and things like that. And since 2015, Taiwan has been consistently ranked number one or number two in all of those metrics worldwide. And the reason is that at the end of 2014, there's a radical U-turn of national direction by embracing the wisdom of the crowd and open government as the national direction. And it was kind of catalyzed and epitomized by an Occupy movement back in 2014, where people occupied the parliament for 22 days in a nonviolent demonstration. And when we say demonstration, we mean it in like the demo day sense, right? It's a demo. Because at the time, the members of the parliament in Taiwan refused to deliberate a cross-strait service trade agreement because they think constitutional Beijing is part of Taiwan or something like that. But in any case, they refused to deliberate a treaty. And so people occupied the parliament and did the MP's work for them by basically deliberating line by line what the service trade pact entails. And there's more than 20 different NGOs in all the different streets around the parliament in a nonviolent way, just deliberating aspects of this cross-strait service agreement. And I was part of the movement that supported the logistics and the ICT communication for this movement. And it's called G0V.TW, or just GovZero. And the idea of GovZero is very simple. For any Taiwan government services that all end in gov.tw, we just registered this domain, g0v.tw, so that people, whenever they see a government service or website that's not to the people's liking, they can just fork that website and build a more interactive open version that just changes the O to a zero on your URL, and it's very easy to discover. It solves the discoverability problem. So like for the legislation, legislative UNGOVTW, the corresponding shadow government is just ly.g0v.tw. It's very easy to remember. It's a very neat hack, right? So the first project of the GovZero movement back in 2012, before I joined, was called budget.g0v.tw, and it's essentially an interactive platform that shows a visualization of the national budget, and everybody can just look on the part, the specific project that they're interested in, have a real-time discussion on the discussion forum, centered on that budget item as the social object instead of on the budget as a whole. And the idea, again, is forking the government, and usually the GovZero projects are under either a free software license or really the Creative Commons Zero license, which is not a license, it's just a declaration to donation to the public domain. And the result is that when the state level government at the end of 2014 want to incorporate this into like the participatory budget program and things like that, they don't have to ask anyone. They just take the GovZero forked versions and merge it back to the state level governments. And so far there's like 7 different cities adopting this. And as of this year, the national government also merged this in, so that today in join.gov.tw you can see all the 1300 national projects and all its KPIs, its deliverables and things like that, and have a real-time discussion with the career public servants in charge of that governmental project, essentially bypassing the representative democratic system. And so it enables a real discussion. So why are there so many civic hackers in Taiwan who during the Sunflower Movement, just like me, I just, you know, talk to my clients that I need to take a 3-week leave because democracy needs me, right? There's hundreds of people who did that back in 2014. And why is that? Because I think I'm 37 now. We're the first generation in Taiwan that can actually do democracy after 3 decades of martial law, which was lifted in 1989 around the time of personal computers, and we only had our first presidential election in 1996, which is about a year of the popularization of the World Wide Web. So internet and democracy, they're not two things, they're not two different branches of people, it's the same generation people, it's the same thing in Taiwan. And so the advent of democracy and the advent of internet and direct democracy is the same time in Taiwan. We don't have like 200 or 300 years of a representative democracy tradition. When we had democracy, we had also the internet. So in Taiwan, when we see or when we talk about free software, we translate it as 自由, so it's always free as in freedom to, you know, assemble, freedom of speech, freedom to express, and never free of cost, because we know that freedom is never free of costs. Our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation fought very hard to get those freedoms, and it's up to us to use the software freedoms to keep the society free. And so at the end of 2014 and after the Occupy, there's many mayor candidates who were Occupy supporters or occupiers themselves who very surprisingly found themselves elected mayors when they did not expect. It's something that also happened in Spain also, right? And in many other, occupies in that time. And so at the time, the premier during the Occupy resigned, saying, I don't understand you people, and so he just resigned. And a new premier, an engineer, said, okay, so from now on, crowdsourcing and open governance is just going to be the national direction. And so the Occupiers and us, the supporters of the Occupies, the facilitators and the ICT experts, were then hired into the national government in early 2015 to help designing systems to collaboratively solve issues such as Uber at the time. And Uber in 2015 has entered Taiwan and operated legally using rental cars and professional drivers for a while. But in 2015, they also introduced a new line of service called Uber X, and it is using unlicensed drivers and unlicensed cars and without insurance. And the PR idea of Uber at the time is to use this meme, which is a virus of the mind, right? This meme called sharing economy. This meme means very different thing to very different people, but for the Uber PR department at the time, it means very specifically that code dispatch cars better than laws, so we obey code, not laws. So it's like very simple message that spreads around the world. It's not just in Taiwan. And so it's a like epidemic of the mind. So people, after becoming a driver for a couple weeks, maybe they feel that there's no protection, that they didn't actually earn that much, and they quit driving for UberX, but during that 2 weeks time, just like a common flu, they would have spread through apps to their passengers and to other drivers and to other passengers. And so it's impossible actually at a time for us to negotiate with an app or with a virus of a mind like the sharing economy, quote unquote, because it's in a different category. It's impossible to argue with the common flu either, right? So at a time, many state governments try use old world methods such as confiscating, like in Paris, they confiscated the office, confiscated the machines, put people to jail, and then the next morning Uber still operates, right? So it doesn't really work in the old governmental methods. And so we thought about it, and we thought that, you know, during the Occupy, where people listen to each other's positions deeply and feel each other's feelings around the CSSTA, maybe we can reuse some of that technique and to work on the Uber issue. Basically, we think that deliberation is a vaccine of the mind. Once people have really felt and empathized with different sides' positions and come up with common values, people become immune to specific virus of the mind in the future. So I promise to check the questions at this point, so I'm just going to do it right now. Right. There's 17 questions. Maybe I'll just... All right. So I'll finish this section and then switch right back to questions. So a proper deliberation involves four different stages. We used a system invented in Canada in 2005. It's called a focus conversation method, or FCM. And it's known as the ORID method also, because it separates the discussion into four different stages. The first is objective, or facts, where people ask each other, like the government publishes open data, all we know about UberX. And we also ask all the private sector and civil society to donate data into this shared fact-checked database. And once people check the facts on the timeline, we can all agree with the facts, the various stakeholders then express their feelings. For the same fact, you may feel angry and I may feel happy, and it's all okay. And it's not until we checked everybody's feelings that we find that there's some resonating feelings that people all feel as important concerns to ideate on. So after the facts, the feelings is the ideas. The best ideas are the ideas that takes care of the most people's feelings. And once we uncover those ideas, we then translate it into legalese. Now, using the old governmental method, the main barrier is the language barrier. The professional public servants, the private sector lobbyists, and the independent like academics and so on use a professional language, while people on the street using a different language. And so under this situation, when people say the same thing but mean very different things, the facts and the feelings gets clouded, and ideas in this environment become ideologies. Ideologies are an even more potent virus of mind that blinds people to new facts and to each other's feelings. And so after we get everybody on the same page, checking the facts that by itself is important, we use a free software system under AGPL called Polis. And Polis is a so-called AI-powered conversation that basically just provides a face to the crowd. So we ask everybody to basically look at one statement that their friends or just a random person on the internet proposed about their feeling, their 感觉, 我觉得 something, so I think that or I feel that. Passenger liability insurance is important. So as you agree or disagree with the statements, your avatar will move among your social media friends, or you don't have to log in among well-known people on social media, so that you can discover that so your friends and your family actually think about this in a very different perspective, but they're still your friends and family, you just didn't talk about this over dinner. So it makes it difficult for people to antagonize, to treat people with different viewpoints as enemies, but rather it enables people to say that, okay, after answering a few yes and no questions, I can also contribute my feelings, and people kind of compete on feelings that resonates with the most number of people, because we say if your ideas or if your feelings resonates with a supermajority amount of people, that is across all the groups, every group has more than majority agreeing with you, then the feelings and proposals with the most resonance, with the most consensus, we use that as the agenda to talk with the stakeholders, with the taxi unions, with the Uber people, and so on. And so in this way, we send the same URL to everybody, and they spread it. And one of the key interface design decisions during a Polis discussion, unlike many other social media venues, is that you don't see the reply button here. There is no reply. And what we discovered is if you have reply, people focus their energy on discrediting the person who posted a comment that they don't agree with. But like Slido, Polis basically, if you see something that you don't agree with, your best recourse is to propose something more nuanced that other people can agree with. And so after a few weeks, in all the police discussions, what we see is that people recognize their differences in those divisive statements, but they don't spend more time on it. And people instead spend a lot of time on refining the nuanced consensus so that people can resonate, kind of compete with the most resonance across the different groups. And so we use a live consultation method where all the stakeholders are invited, the taxi company, Uber, union people, and so on, the co-ops, and so on. And we just checked with them all the agenda set by this police conversation one by one, saying, do you agree? And if you don't, why? If you do, why? And because it's live stream with thousands of people watching, people become bound to whatever they have said. So Uber at the time said, okay, so we'll work with our drivers to help them obtain professional driver's license, and they're bound by the words they spoke at this live stream meeting. And so after this, we then work on ratifying the new, what we call the diversification of taxi. And one of the highest score is actually contributed by the free software community, by Irvin from the Mozilla community here, who said that we should take this opportunity to upgrade the taxi regulations so that the best practices from Uber, for example, taxi doesn't have to be painted yellow, and there's the two-way rating system and so on, could be used to facilitate better taxi qualities here in Taiwan. And so led by that consensus and six other consensus items, we then created a law so that now Uber is operating legally in Taiwan, but only with registered drivers, licensed cars, and you also get email about your rides and insurance and so on every Uber ride, and you can also call taxi with Uber, and actually vice versa. And so this is what we call a multi-stakeholder consultation, and after which people's consensus set the agenda for the politicians to talk about. So let's take some questions. So there's 13 people, I think 15 now, would like to know, how can we help other governments enable open standards? This is an excellent question. So in Taiwan, we have this idea of the GDSP, or the Government Digital Service Principle. It is modeled loosely after the Government Digital Service in the UK, who also published their digital standards. And the GDS is kind of a thought leader in this area, and they pioneered a lot of digital standards that are not just open as in open source, or open as in open protocol or format, but open as in open innovation, where people, everybody can contribute. And one of their key principles is being user-centric, which we hear expanded in Taiwan, meaning that the users here not only include citizens, but also people working in the front line in the public service. And the second thing that the UK GDS also basically advocates is that when you build a digital service, you need not to only test with people and the frontline staff, but also test with the minister in the cabinet from the beginning to the end, because ultimately they're accountable for this digital service, and they can then solicit more idea, open innovation from this service. And again, we adopted this spirit and also call for the leader to be basically cross-disciplinary. But I think the person who asked this question is maybe most interested in our GDSP number 8, which says open first, basically. Open is the priority. And basically to reduce the time spent on this, developing services and the total cost of ownership, open should be the foremost principle when designing and building services. And by open, we mean specifically that all the machine-to-machine data built by this system need to be available under an open license, most commonly the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license, which is the default license for all the ICT systems built in Taiwan. And also we prioritize open source. And if the service component reuses existing open source components, we recommend people to use Linux Foundation's SPDX or SPDX manifest to basically solve this warranty issue issue for the system integrators, because once they declare their reusable free software components under SPDIX, the warranty in the legal perspective has a clear delineation. And so by this, we want to encourage people to innovate based on what the government has delivered and improve on existing government services by forking the government and occasionally getting it right and getting government merging it back. But not only open data and open source, we also say that it needs to conform with open standards, and so that it could be reused, and also it's built on common API and common components. And all this is so that we can quickly reiterate and improve the services. And so we have a support group of all the governments who endorse this standard. It's called Digital Nations, and previously known as Digital 5 or Digital 7, depending on the number of people in it. But we have a chat channel, we share GitHub repositories, we basically communicate very regularly, so that the governments who embrace open by default has this venue. And I think our next meeting is in Forward 50 in Ottawa in Canada this November. And so basically all the governments are solving very much similar issues, and all the components that we deliver is not just for improvement of our citizens, but also offering it so that it could be reused by the government and people building their own self-governance system, not necessarily state government or representative governments worldwide. So the short answer to this is to develop and adhere to a clear government digital service principle, to publish and circulate this widely, to encourage this in the procurement laws, and to encourage this in the accountability, in the auditing laws, in the statistics laws, which we all have done, and then participate internationally in support groups in the democratic and open governance governments, and basically share these best practices, or at least better practices, as open toolkits. And that's the thing that we're doing. 12 people would like me to answer, what do I wish from Debian? So I wish that Debian live long and prosper, and because really, along with other large endeavors, right, like the Mozilla Foundation and the Linux Foundation, which I just mentioned, the Wikimedia Foundation, so you folks are the foundation upon which that we're advocating to the representative democratic system that, hey, there is some merit in this kind of radical transparency and a kind of radical participation. And as a anarchist, conservative anarchist minister, I have three conditions going in the cabinet. The first is that I don't issue a command to anyone, nor do I take a command. Everything is by voluntary association. And this is straight from the Debian Constitution, where by constitution, nobody can really be forced into doing any non-voluntary work. And the second one is that I get to work anywhere on the planet, and it still counts as working. So it's teleworking, and it also enabled a lot of e-government apparatus when people discover that by a paper-based delivery, they can't really reach me. Well, they can reach me after a week or so. It is far easier if you just use email. But the third thing also very important is that when I develop this voluntary co-creation methodologies, it is important for me to be radically transparent. And by radical transparency, I mean not just meeting with lobbyists and journalists are all published online. Even internal meetings that I chair, we also publish everything as a transcript 2 weeks after every internal meeting. And so it looks like this. It's also using a free software system called Sayit, developed by, I think, My Society. In the UK. So like when Debbie Plouffe, speaking for Uber at the time, come to lobby and have a conversation, not only is our discussion on the record, it's on 360 record, so we can put on a VR cardboard or something and relive the conversation. And every utterance has a permanent URL, so you can get full accountability of who said what, where. And this is important for the government service, because the public servants in this situation, they become become very innovative, contrary to popular belief. Because previously, when something gets right and people like it, the minister always takes all the credit. And if something gets wrong, it's always the career public servants who, you know, didn't execute well or something, and the netizens has a way to blame the people in charge for it. So it in that situation, there's no motivation for them to innovate. But now, with this radically transparent system, not only is the civil society more understanding of the context before making a decision, but also all the credit gets shared to the actual career public servants who propose something innovative in the first place. And if anything goes wrong, well, because far as I know, I'm the only minister in the world doing this, it's all Audrey's fault. So basically, people, I can absorb the blame while people share the credit. So we get a lot of very innovative ideas, frankly, from the public service, such as adopting a thoroughly free software system called Sandstorm.io for our entire public service and in all the different branches of government, not just the administration. And so basically, we use only free software on this Sandstorm.io system. Davros replaces Dropbox, EtherCalc replaces Google Spreadsheet, EtherPad replaces Google Doc, we can replace this Trello, and there's also Rocket Chat, and I'm sure you know the other tools that the free software people uses. And basically, we say any public servants, as long as they have a GOVTW email address, can enjoy this for free and even develop new applications on it because it's cybersecurity hardened. We ask our best white hat hackers to attack it and filed a few CVEs so that we're reasonably sure that it's very secure now, so that people can develop applications by themselves, which is free software, and like, I don't know, planning travels together, ordering lunch boxes together, and things like that, and unleash innovation within the government because they know that this system can absorb the cybersecurity risk and I can absorb the political risk. 17 people would like to know, quote, it's good that you discovered Debian and what makes it interesting at such a young age. Do you run Debian yourself? Have you contributed to Debian? Personally, my desktop environment, when I started learning, I think it's around 1999, like system level programming, I'm sorry, has always been FreeBSD. And so I've never actually, I used the Debian compatibility layer. I don't know whether that counts or not, but I've always been a FreeBSD developer and contributed to also driver support in FreeBSD, and also most of my contributions in the Perl community and in Open Foundry here in Taiwan in the early 2000s were first committed to the FreeBSD port system. So it's a different culture. It's not copy left, it's not copy right, it's copy center. You go to the copy center and make many copies, and so that's a very permissive community. That's my primary community, the FreeBSD community. But there's various efforts within Debian to reconcile with, for example, the module signing system. I piloted the module signing system in CPEN in the Comprehensive Perl Archive Network, and so there's a lot of packaging issues and so on, so I basically chime in from here to there, but I did not participate in the Debian democracy, but I really admire it from afar in the FreeBSD camp. Yeah. Does Taiwan has an open source strategy? Yes, I'm glad you asked. So it's called DigiPlus. And I don't know how much of this is translated into English. Oh, all of it. Okay, it's good. So if you go to smart.taiwan.gov.tw, so we tend to have one web page for each major government policies. So there's smart.taiwan.gov.tw, there's AI Taiwan, there's Bio Taiwan, there's also CI Taiwan. I think that's not yet translated, where the CI stands for Civil IoT, which is the shared open data and also open algorithm platform for all the different environmental data aggregated in a supercomputing center that combines the people's, like the GovZero side of air sensors and also the government side of government sensors, and so that we can all talk with the same fact-based or evidence-based policymaking process. So I encourage you to check out Smart Taiwan and also links to Asia, Silicon Valley, and things like that. And so when we talk about open society here and also about the education, like interdisciplinary digital talents. In the DigiPlus plan, we specifically said, especially in the basic education level, that is to say K-12 level, but also because in the next 5 years, all the college level students also need to learn computational thinking and programming, half of it, I think, by the year like 2021 or something. All of it needs to be based on free software. If the student graduates and joins the private sector and choose to use proprietary software, that is their choice, and of course the government can't do much about it. But while they're still children, while they're still in the schools, it is very important for us to not let the children or the students to be subject to vendor lock-in, so that by the time they graduate, maybe the vendor has already moved somewhere else, maybe the vendor lose interest in that product line, and we see a lot of that dynamic. So at least in the education system, we're very firm that we prefer free software for education. And when teaching computational thinking, when teaching artificial intelligence, when teaching all those different, DigiPlus power, smart machinery, green energy technology, and so on, we prefer free software when it's in the school. And so in the DigiPlus, there is a strategy to raise awareness and have talents in school. And there's also TWOSS.io, I think, I hope I remember this right, which is not yet translated to English. Oh, it's somewhat translated to English, but in any case, yes, so what this tries to do is basically by getting people sufficient education materials so people working on any level of education can point to existing communities and introduce their students to such community, and even people working in like C-level government or national level government can also point to the work cases of incorporating like PostgreSQL or like OpenStack or Docker ecosystem or TensorFlow or whatever, and which is the success story, and you're replacing proprietary systems. And because it's not about procurement anymore, we already changed our procurement regulations and the government digital service principle. All that people need now is a boost of confidence, of 鼓励式, basically, by people keep telling them it's okay to use free software. And so this is the TWOSS.io endeavor. And if you find anything wrong with it or anything you can contribute, please feel free to let us know in TWOSS. Why is Taiwan so restrictive on internet access, captive portals, registrar's ID for iTunes and Wi-Fi access, etc.? Is there a reason, bad experiences or not? Well, the reason is usually cited as, quote, cybersecurity, unquote, but it is not a very strong reason. We are actively looking, actually, like in the Taiwan high-speed rails to relax the captive portal, because especially when you're on a high-speed moving train, it is very difficult to actually resume from hotspot to hotspots if you need to go through like five or three screens to register. So that's the first place where we will relax this captive portal thing. And then once this is done and piloted and proven that there it really doesn't need to more cybersecurity guards, that we can put other cybersecurity guards elsewhere on the stack, not necessarily on the personal identification level, then we will also relax the internal within the government agencies. We often provide two Wi-Fis, one for employees of the government and one called iTaiwan, also for visitors. So the visitor Wi-Fi, we then will also look to relax more. And that's because those two venues in the high-speed rails and also in visitors to government agencies, you already did your registration somewhere else. We don't physically actually need you to register again. I'm less sure about the city-level public Wi-Fi, like TPE free or other state level Wi-Fi, because they have a certain level of autonomy and we don't actually dictate what they do. But we just pilot this relaxed login portal thing and also establish corresponding cybersecurity rules, and maybe the state level people will also get enlightened. We'll see. There's 11 people who want to know, is it possible to be a citizen in Taiwan and interact fully with the government without using any proprietary software? I'm glad you asked, because that's one of the cases that I like to show. it used to be very, very difficult. So just last May, actually, there was a petition that talks explicitly about it. and very explicit. last May, there was a e-petition, our national e-petition system, which after 5,000 people participate online, you can use email or SMS, it's not a real name basis, but basically after 5,000 people countersigned a petition, the government is obliged to respond to it. And this petition is by this user experience designer, Zhuo Zhiyuan, which says that our text filing system is explosively hostile to users. So it's kind of negative energy in that petition. There's more negative energy in the body, which I will spare you the quote. But basically, at the time, about 80% of comments in that petition discussion area is very negative. It calls for the resignment of the Minister of Finance. It calls, there's a lot of accusations to the vendors who provide the system, and all because in Windows, there is a proprietary Windows-based application for text filing, but for Linux and for Mac and basically non-Windows systems, there is a Java applet. And because last year, Oracle Inc. Deprecated Java applets, the user experience become very, very bad. People will see that, please wait, it's still installing some applet components, but because the pop-up is by default blocked, right? So nothing happens, and after 40 minutes, people are still waiting. And so it really is very, very difficult to use. And after the e-petition, we basically, there's a participation officer team in each ministry, and each participation officer, or POs, is responsible, just like media officer who talk to journalists or parliamentary officer who talk to MPs, POs talk to such emergent petitions. And by basically saying, I think not only very quick, like 36 hours after this petition, our PO Yang Jingheng just posted publicly that everybody who complained about our text filing experience on non-Windows systems is cordially invited to a co-creation workshop some Friday in the Ministry of Finance. And this is very interesting because just by proposing this invitation, previously like 80% of people were just flaming and 20% of people were saying, well, we're using Windows, it works kind of okay, but nobody really take heed to them. After this invitation is sent, 80% of people started proposing useful suggestions, useful recommendations, and only less than 20% still remained trolling or flaming people, but people don't pay attention to them anymore. So basically, what we did was inviting the trolls, and who turns out to be not trolls, they were just fed up with the text filing system, and they had to vent their feelings. But after they vent their feelings, we all then solicit ideas from them, and people who can make it to Taipei, otherwise people can still participate using live streaming. And one of the key thing here is radical transparency and also accountability, meaning that people who say that it's, you know, the words are explosively crowded, we just put that posted as words are explosively crowded, that it is so brilliantly written that people are confused, and then we just post it. And people say, you know, instead of designing a system that makes people feel better, people don't feel good at all when they think about filing taxes, and so we should shorten the experience instead of trying to make people feel better, and so on. And so basically people who propose such ideations online, we just use service design methodologies and hold five co-creation workshops with all the different stakeholders involved in the text filing experience. So that this year, the text filing experience for non-Windows systems is entirely HTML5 based, it adheres to the open standards, people can just use any platform that can run a browser to access the text filing system. So the short question to short answer to this question is that it has become more and more possible while we translate or transform existing desktop oriented or Windows specific or Java applets into web-based situations. Now if you insist that all the JavaScript libraries and CSS libraries that government system use has also to be open source or free software, that would take a little bit more time. You will need the current generation of system to be wholly replaced by post-government digital service principle post-GDSP systems, but we are focusing on reducing the load on the client side first. So at a time, I think you can complete most of the interactions of the governmental issues like filing taxes and so on. If you're okay with using a free software browser, but there's still some proprietary JavaScript code, this is kind of the compromise situation we're in at the moment. But with the rollout of GDSP, we're also looking to make the JavaScript and CSS and also the backend systems more non-proprietary. Anonymous would like to know, the shared objects in the text filing plugin is not open source. Why? Because the copyright belongs to, I think, the vendor, Zhonghua Telecom. And back when we signed the agreement with the Zhonghua Telecom, the GDSP was not in effect. And so the contract basically attributed the copyright to the vendor who only conferred usage right to the government and the citizens. This is a mistake that we will not repeat. But at the moment, we don't have the legal recourse for the current generation of plugin systems to be relicensed as free software. I tried. But the easiest way is just for the next version of identification methods, such as the National Healthcare Card, which, by the way, is currently in public consultation. If you want to contribute, like you demand free software stack for the entire Medicare system, please feel free to go to join.gov.tw, where we are now asking for consultation on people who are looking to virtualize their universal Medicare card and or to use NFC-based authentication. So we want to know about people's preference when it comes to the technology, to the regulations, as well as to the total cost of ownership and also of usage. And so if you feel strongly about it, please do contribute online on join platform so that we can say to the people writing the contracts that people really feel that is very important for our next generation authentication methods to be non-proprietary. So please. All right, so 8 people would like to know, what is your opinion on e-commerce application refusing to operating on restriction of free devices like rooted Androids and jailbroken iDevices? Is it fair? Well, mostly I think they do this with the call to, you know, quote, fraud prevention, unquote. It's not about fairness. I think it is about the choice or the freedom of choice or the liberty of users. The reason why GDSP prefers free software is because when it comes to healthcare or tax filing, there really is no choice. To be a citizen in Taiwan, you have to go through some government-sponsored API endpoints to produce some, you know, government-sponsored form data and so on. And because there is no choice, we really need to be open so that people can hold us to account to be more transparent and also innovate on existing solutions. But for e-commerce applications where there are no de facto monopolies, when people still have a choice, the government at the moment does not take a stance against the e-commerce apps who uses fraud detection or prevention methods that result in incompatibility with rooted Androids and jailbroken iDevices. I think one of the possible direction out of this dilemma is to basically talk to people who work on quote fraud prevention unquote, and just like how we talked with the high-speed rails and the government agencies providing iTaiwan software and Wi-Fi for free, we basically said you can do your fraud prevention or cybersecurity on another layer in this system and not in the particular layer of requiring a captive portal and the MAC. Address, which is very easy to spoof anyway, right? So I think just by talking to people like this, or we talk to people who advocate copyright protection through blocking of the internet, we say, you know, with IPv6, it's getting more and more impossible, and watermarking or real-time watermarking methodologies, it infringes on the consumers or customers' experiences less, and it is actually a better solution overall than just banning entire websites and so on. So people have legitimate interests, there are legitimate stakes, but as I said, Often we think of it as like a tug of war, but in many different cases it is possible actually with some what we call social innovation, a innovation that basically takes care of all the different sides of interest and leaves nobody worse off. So I would encourage people to feel strongly about it, to contact your local friendly e-commerce association like Wudianmian Shangye Tongye Gonghui and so on, who does have a forum to talk about things like this. We use that forum to talk about fraud detection and prevention of like people selling counterfeit goods on Facebook to pretty good effect. So I would also encourage you to contact your local association about it. Can we see any legislators supporting free software in the government movement like public money, public code from the EFF? Well, in Taiwan, when you see this government, the GDSP, we already say this, right? This is public code, this is open data, and this is open standards, and also common APIs. And we used also a Linux Foundation project called OAS3, which was Swagger, to say that all the different systems built, as long as it has a machine-to-machine component, need to adhere to this machine-to-machine open API specification. And the reason why we put an equal amount of attention on the source code license versus the machine-to-machine integration is that if we only talk about public code or the license, it is very often that a system integrator will deliver something that is technically free software, but it depends on, for example, expensive Oracle systems or even more expensive DB2 systems and things like that. And that basically still restricts the reuse across different ministries and agencies. But by saying, you know, for all the import and export, for all the batch level access, by basically treating machine-to-machine accessibility the same way we treat universal access, like for blind people, we basically say, while you may still depend on Oracle or DB2 at a point, the next vendor can just build on your API and even batch export what's in this public money paid database and rebuild a service without depending on any proprietary technological stack. So I would argue that the freedom of portability is as important as freedom to fork and freedom to reuse, and both are, of course, very important. And constitutional, I'm not supposed to speculate on legislators, but there's various younger legislators in all the different parties who are also interested in this area. Is there any chance, people would like to know, that I can urge deans of higher education facilities like NCTU to deploy IP version 6? Well, it's kind of a bootstrapping problem, isn't it? But this year, we see a surge of IPv6 adoption, actually, after Taiwanic change hands and embrace a very IPv6 first roadmap. We see, for example, Zhonghua Telecom has drastically increased the IPv6 connectivity of their mobile clients, and we also see other telecoms and other peering institutions and ISPs starting to adopt this trend. And so once there's sufficient amount of people using the clients that are IPv6 enabled and even IPv6 preferred, there will be sufficient pressure then for the service providers to provide as good, if not better, service over IPv6. And so I feel your QQ. I help you your QQ, but I bang QQ, right? But I think really it is up to the students and the clients and the users of the internet, the last mile providers, to first build a useful and usable IPv6 environment before we can then demand the service providers to do so. But we are seeing pretty good trends as of this year, and so if you come back next year, I think there will be sufficient demand from the users side to have the institutional internet service providers to provide IPv6 also. So I'm technically out of time, so I'll just take one last question. What is my opinion of the European Union General Data Protection Regulation, or the GDPR? My opinion is that the GDPR is a much needed conversation that translates the idea of data from what people will confuse with assets, intellectual properties, which are leaky abstractions that doesn't mean anything, to a what we call data agency or a relationship-based worldview. Basically, as a government institution, if I hold your data, this is the beginning of a relationship where you can ask what happens to the data, who can update the data so it reflects the purpose, and if I try to use the data in any way other than pure statistics, I need to check with you first so that you can, you know what's going on and provide the most up-to-date data instead of leaving, you know, just a shadow digital trail that's 5 years out of date that results in more bias. And so I think data agency and data as a relationship and also data accountability interestingly translate in Mandarin as three different words. For people who ask for accountability, it's called 问责. For us who are held accountable, it's called 当责. We should be accountable. And the system within it that holds both sides together, the relationship, is called 客责机制, or a accountability mechanism. So 问责, 当责, and 客责 is a relational concept. It is not a one-time transactional concept. And I think GDPR is a much needed wake-up call for everybody to see data as relationship and not as some digital asset or intellectual property. So thank you very much.